Good morning.
Good morning.
I arrived early this morning and, you know, I was witness to how much work it takes to put this place together. And really, it's all about community these times. And, you know, as I sat there and listened to joy and sorrows, the joy of the children, and the sorrows that we hurt, and it's all about life. It's an honor and a blessing to be with you all this morning. These are uncertain and tenuous times following the presidential election that was divisive, aggressive, disrespectful to many, and at the same time was free of substance that could make us individually or as a country better people. And all of that ended up in an unprecedented outcome that makes many of us worry about the future of this nation. I grew up in Iran, and I came here to study as a student almost 4 years ago. And I landed in JFK Airport in New York and fell asleep while waiting for a connecting flight to Cleveland. And I can tell you that I experienced incredible kindness and compassion by people who I did not know. Airline employees, airport employees, others who were strangers to me. And that kindness has continued over the course of my life here, and that's really contributed to making me who I am today. And the world has changed a whole lot in the past 40 years. And I worry that those students or nationals who come here from other countries, particularly from developing countries, won't experience the same caring and compassion that was granted to me. Hopefully I'm wrong. Meanwhile, life goes on, and we still have to manage our daily struggles and challenges, and we have to manage our own emotions and adhere to core principles so that we can live and lead our lives peacefully and mindfully. So this morning, what I thought is I would share with you five things that have helped me lead my life and my work as the director of a state agency that's in charge of helping youth who have committed serious crimes and offenses. But to help those kids, we first have to make sure that we, myself, and the employees who work for that agency model the values that we would like to see in them. If I want my staff and my kids to act mindfully, then I have to be willing and able to practice and to model mindfulness. For a country or a community to be mindful, individuals have to be mindful. This work is really about us as individuals, and my message is about that. It's not about anyone else. It's about me as an individual and what I need to do in order to basically live mindfully and work through these times. And naturally, you can take that message, and if it applies to you, hopefully it will be of service. The first concept that I want to share with you is the power of impression. And I'll just say a few words about that. With every step that I take, with every word that I speak, with every interaction that I engage in, I am making an impression. And ultimately, a reputation that follows me for the rest of my life. And in these difficult times, it is extremely important, as challenging as it might be, to be aware and mindful of how I express myself and how I talk to others who don't agree with me. How I show up every day to work with my family and loved ones. And am I demonstrating what my core principles are in life? I guess the question for you would be, or for us collectively, if we are a member of the UU congregation, is are we collectively demonstrating the principles of this congregation and what we are learning every day? Are we able to model that every day in our lives? Are we creating an impression of peace and mindfulness, even as difficult as these times are? Practicing and modeling our core values is at the heart of mindful living, and I hope that in light of everything that's happening, we do not lose sight of that. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is understanding the difference between power and force. We seem to confuse these two concepts quite often together. And David Hawkins, who's a psychologist who lives in Sedona, Arizona, explains this concept clearly in his book, Power versus Force. Hawkins tells us that power arises from meaning. It has to do with motive, and it has to do with principle. Force is incomplete and has to be fed energy constantly. Power, on the other hand, is total and complete in itself, and it does not require anything from the outside. Power generates life energy. Force takes that energy away. When I was 17 years old, I went to a military recruitment center in Tehran, capital of Iran, with my brother-in-law. And I don't remember exactly the nature of the business that we were there, but I do remember these long lines. And those of us who've come from poor countries or developing countries know the lines. In fact, you know, there's this humorous, I don't think it's true, but I'll share it with you, story from Soviet Union. After, you know, Perestroika, and you all remember Mikhail Gorbachev, great guy. I hope he was the leader of Soviet Union today. But anyways, there's this story about this guy standing in line after Perestroika, long line that was not moving, and he gets very upset and leaves, and people ask him, well, where are you going? And he says, I'm going to go hurt Gorbachev, because he explained all these reforms and none of them have happened. And he came back after a couple of hours and quietly assumed his space, his place in the line. People asked him, well, what happened? He said, well, that line was longer than this one. So you know, I mean, I'm not kidding you. Lines in embassies, in other places, you stand in line for days. So here I am, 17 years of age, in this military recruitment center. And there are several lines, and you know, we're standing in one of them, and I go to the front of the line and ask a soldier who had a gun with him, very politely, sir, you know, we are here for this business. Is this the right line? His response was short but not sweet. He said, shut up and go back and stand in line. And a few different responses went through my head, but what came out of my mouth was, thank you. And of course, that response was out of fear, and it took me many years to recognize that that soldier or the gun that he was carrying had no power. And that with that gun taken away from that soldier, he became pretty much like anyone else. And, you know, I see the same confusion about this concept of force and power in the kids who come to us at Oregon Youth Authority. They perceive that a firearm gives them a source of power and actually earns them respect, not realizing what they're acquiring is actually false power and false respect. Now, through contemplation, meditation, mindfulness practices, some of them, and I know some of them, become enlightened human beings, and they're able to connect with that internal source of power that gives them permanent respect without using violence, without using force, and without paying anything for that gift. In this past election, we had very few demonstration of authentic power. Everything was about demonstrating force. So it becomes so important for us, first of all, to understand the difference between those two concepts, and then be able to explain it to our children, and grandchildren and share with them the example of those enlightened beings, Christ, Gandhi, Dr. King, Nelson Mandela, Thich Nhat Hanh, and I can go on, who demonstrated authentic power without ever compromising principle and without ever adhering to the use of force. The third thing that I wanted to talk to you about is about the illusion of control. Those of us who have teenagers or have had teenagers know what I'm talking about. But also in this election, you know, as individuals, we realize that we have no control. That control is primarily an illusion. When I came to this country, and this was prior to the Islamic Republic in Iran, people would ask me, where are you from? I would say, I'm from Iran. And those who would know where Iran is generally reacted very positively. What a great country, great civilization, great history and culture. And all of that changed, for those of you who are old enough to remember, in 1979 with the hostage crisis. And overnight, I became associated with a group of people that I had nothing to do with. And it's the same with us today. We are all perceived as Americans. And Europeans think that there's something wrong with us mentally. And even though we might have not voted all the same way in this election, all of us are being judged in the same way. So, as an Iranian student, I had to go to the immigration office in Portland and be fingerprinted. And that was a humiliating experience. And as I was sitting in that immigration office, nervous, somewhat angry, not really know what to expect, I walked into the room, and the individual who was doing the fingerprinting just took a moment, looked me in the eye, and he said, I'm so sorry I have to do this. This is my job. You know, it's not something I'd like to do, but let's work together and get through it. Those few words, those 10 seconds of conversation changed the trajectory of my life. I walked out of that office, not carrying the chip on my shoulder, not feeling like a victim. And all throughout these years, even with 9/11 and everything else, all negative elements that are associated with people from the Middle East, I've never felt targeted or discriminated against. And I feel that some of that has to do with me. And never feeling like a victim. That is the power of impression. That's the power of words. That's the power of interactions. So though control is an illusion, influence is not. We have a great degree of influence in the environments that we live in, with our surroundings, and it becomes our responsibility to use that influence in the most peaceful and mindful manner as we go through these days and weeks following this election. That becomes our vocation. The fourth concept that I want to talk to you about is the power of love. And there's already been much said about love today in the songs and the words that were spoken. I've been to Israel and Palestine twice, once in 1990 and once in 2002, both of those trips as part of a citizen peace delegation to speak to all sides and basically get a better understanding of what's happening on the ground. And I remember in 2002, we were observing a demonstration outside the city of Bethlehem. And of course, you know, we were not participating, we were observers. There were a very large crowd, probably more than 1,000 Palestinians. And perhaps even an equal number of Israeli soldiers with heavy machinery, guns, etc. And those of you who know anything about the Israeli army know that they're probably the best trained in the world how to deal with terrorism, with anything else that they might face. And though the demonstration was peaceful, there was an argument that broke out between a Palestinian family and an Israeli soldier. Voices were raised, tension began to escalate, and I got a really bad feeling that something was going, something bad was going to happen here. And just as, you know, the escalation got to the point of almost explosion, the grandmother of the family walked up to the Israeli soldier with an olive branch, gave him this olive branch and gave him a kiss on the cheek. Now this soldier, this young man, has been trained in how to deal with any act of terrorism, but he was not trained in how to deal with love. So he froze for about 10 or 20 seconds. It seemed like longer than that, but probably about that. And, you know, he gave her a hug and a kiss, and the entire tension dissipated and dissolved, and everybody cheered. That's the power of love. Stronger than any weapons of mass destruction. What a country needs today, more than anything, is the practice of authentic love. And you know, love as a concept is so convoluted in this culture. When we talk about love, authentic love, we're really talking about the greatest demonstration of that authenticity, and the best example of that for me is the love between a mother and a child. My mom is, nobody knows how old she is. She claims to be 90, 91 years old. But you know, she is really a treasure in my life. I have lunch with her every Wednesday, and there's no one that can love us like our mothers. So that's really, when I talk about love, I'm talking about that kind of authenticity, and that's what we need in this country in order to start the healing process. And that has to be demonstrated and modeled by us. We cannot expect others to do it. Finally, I want to highlight the importance of the necessity of having a purpose in life, and how living with purpose can overcome even the most horrific experiences. Viktor Frankl, you know Viktor, who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning, survived the Nazi concentration camp, even though his wife and his parents died in those camps. And he emerged from that experience not with a chip on his shoulder, but actually introducing and inventing a new branch in psychology called logotherapy. Logo in Greek is meaning. So therapy to find meaning in life. He taught us that everything can be taken away from an individual. Everything that I have, everything that I own can be taken away from me. My family can be taken away from me. My belongings, even my identity can be taken away from me. But there is something that nobody can take from me, and that's my internal source of power. And ultimately what Viktor Frankl was talking about is my choice as to how I want to respond to events that happen in life. He writes, "We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in numbers, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken away from a man. But one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given sets of circumstances, to choose one's own way." And so that remains our challenge and our task, to choose our attitude and our own way during these difficult times. I have a copy of Frankl's book close by, and whenever I feel sorry for myself, I read a few pages. And it helps me come back to reality and remind myself that if Frankl survived Nazi concentration camp, then I can survive this, whatever this might be. And if that this is this election that we just went through, we can survive. So, you know, I wanted to not take too much time, because also wanted to be respectful just in case you have any thoughts that you want to share, or if there are any questions. And if they're not, that's fine, but I just wanted to make this time available. I think I still have another 5 minutes square. So, Yes.
Well, I think what you said is very powerful. Tuesday night at Mount Tabor, I missed it because I was on a hike, they did a community group hug. They did community group hug. I don't know how the word got out. Maybe I have to get on Facebook more. But like 200 people showed up at 7 o'clock and they just hugged each other. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was just a wonderful way to prove exactly what you said, choices.
Thank you for sharing that. That's a beautiful demonstration of how we can practice that unconditional love. Yes. It absolutely makes sense. You know, I have learned that in my interaction with children, and especially youth, doesn't really matter what I tell them. Because most likely they won't listen. What they need is to know that I'm real, that I actually love them and care for them. And if they can experience that, you know, even the most scary gang-involved kid that you might not even feel safe in a room with, suffers from a huge lack of self-respect. And the ultimate goal of life for him or her, and it's usually him, girls are much smarter than boys. The most important thing that he needs to achieve, and I need to achieve, is just to feel at peace in our own skin. Just to be in peace with who we are. And to get there, they first need to experience that caring and love from some other person. We had a girl that ran away from one of our transition programs, and luckily we found her before she was harmed. And though she was not happy about being brought back, she says, "This is the first time that I ran and somebody came and looked for me." This is what these kids need. So really, we need to demonstrate to them that they matter, that we listen to them, and ultimately challenge them to find their way. And generally, when you're incarcerated, you have a lot of time. And if that time is spent in reflection and contemplation, they don't connect with that power within. We're actually running mindfulness classes in our facilities. We have Fleet Mall, who started the Prison Mindfulness Institute, come and do day-long retreats with our kids. And many of them tell us that through that meditation and mindfulness practices, they're actually finding that peace that they need to find their path.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing this with us. I just want to lift up, healing is, we do need to heal the rifts that have been created, and there are lots of people for whom the healing process can't start until sort of basic safety and security are established, and there's so much uncertainty about like the types of oppression that are going to be happening. So I think that what you're talking about, you know, coming together is really important as far as healing the rifts between one another, so we can stand with these communities that are going to be threatened and hold power accountable. So there's,
absolutely, and I agree, but really the core of my message today is I'm not focusing on anyone else, I'm focusing on me. Mm-hmm. And how I can take the teaching of this consciousness here and model it in my everyday life. It's much easier to lash back and to engage in the same behavior. I go back to Viktor Frankl, you know, somebody who basically, on the surface, every power was taken away from him in a Nazi concentration camp, and yet he was the most powerful person in that environment, just because of how he approached things and how he looked at things. So the first important thing is for me to center myself and take care of myself, and then I can begin to take care of others, and I have no control over what our president-elect is going to do. What I do know is that communities like this ultimately make the difference. And if we can extend that circle of mindfulness. You know, you go back to Thich Nhat Hanh, you go back to Dr. King. It doesn't matter how much they beat you. You never resort to violence. That's the message. Thank you.
Our closing hymn is 347, Gather the Spirit.